The Unstrung Harp, or Mr. Earbrass Writes a Novel. Mr. Clovis Frederick Earbrass is, of course, the well-known novelist. Of his books, A Moral Dustbin, More Chains Than Clank, Was It Likely, and the Hip Deep Trilogy are perhaps the most admired. Mr. Earbrass is seen on the croquet lawn of his home. Hobbies odd, near collapsed pudding in Mortshire. He is studying a game left unfinished at the end of summer. On November 18th of alternate years, Mr. Earbrass begins writing his new novel. Weeks ago, he chose its title at random from a list of them he keeps in a little green notebook. It being tea time of the 17th, he is alarmed not to have thought of a plot to which the unstrung harp might apply, but his mind will keep reverting to the last biscuit on the plate. Snow was falling when Mr. Earbrass woke, which suggested he open TUH with the first flakes of what could be developed into a prolonged and powerfully purple blizzard. On paper, if not outdoors, they have kept coming down all afternoon. Over and over again, in all possible ways, only now at nightfall, have done so satisfactorily. For writing, Mr. Earbrass affects an athletic sweater of forgotten origin and unknown significance. It is always worn, hindsight too. Several weeks later, the loofah trickling on his knees, Mr. Earbrass mulls over an awkward retrospective bit that ought to go in chapter 2. But where? Even the voice of the omniscient author can hardly afford to interject a seemingly pointless anecdote concerning Ladderback in Tibet, when the other characters are feverishly engaged in wondering whether to have the pond at Deshiver Cottage dragged or not. Mr. Earbrass belongs to the strain rather than to the sedentary type of author. He is never to be found at his desk unless actually writing down a sentence. Before this happens, he broods over it indefinitely while picking up and putting down again small loose objects, walking diagonally across rooms, staring out windows, and so forth. He frequently hums, more in his mind than anywhere else, themes from the Poddington to Deum. It was one of Mr. Earbrass's better days. He wrote for so long and with such intensity that when he stopped, he felt quite sick. Having leaned out a window into a strong wind for several minutes, he is now restoring himself in the kitchen and rereading TUH as far as he has gone. He cannot help but feel that Lerp's return and almost immediate impalement on the bottle tree was one of his better ideas. The jelly in his sandwich is about to get all over his fingers. Mr. Earbrass has finished chapter 7, and it is obvious that before plunging ahead himself, he has got to decide where the plot is to go and what will happen to it on arrival. He is engaged in making diagrams of possible routes and destinations, and wishing he had not dealt so summarily with Lerp, who would have been useful for taking retributive measures at the end of part 3. At the moment, there is no other character capable of them. Out for a short drive before a supper of oysters and trifle, Mr. Earbrass stops near the abandoned fireworks factory outside Something Awful. There is a drowned sort of yellow light in the west, and the impression of desolation and melancholy is remarkable. Mr. Earbrass jots down a few visual notes he suspects may be useful when he reaches the point where the action of TUH shifts to Hangdog Hill. Mr. Earbrass was virtually asleep when several lines of verse passed through his mind and left it hopelessly awake. Here was the perfect epigraph for TUH. A horrid monster has been something delayed. By your their indifference in the dark and the dank brown shade below the garden. His mind's eye sees them quoted on the bottom third of a right-hand page in a possibly olive-bound book he read at least 5 years ago. When he does find them, it will be a great nuisance if no clue is given to their authorship. Mr. Yerbrass is driven over to another millstone in search of forced green gauges, but he has been distracted by a bookseller's rummaging along among mostly religious tracts and privately printed reminiscences. He has come across The Meaning of the House, his second novel, and making sure it has not got there by mistake, as he would hardly care to pay more for it. He discovers it is a presentation copy. For Angus, will you ever forget the bloaters? Bloaters? Angus? The first draft of TUH is more than half finished, and for some weeks its characters have been assuming a fitful and cloudy reality. Now a minor one named Glassglue has materialized at the head of the stairs, as his creator is about to go down to dinner. Mr. Earbrass was aware of the peculiarity, unpleasant nubs on his greatcoat, but not the blue-tinted spectacles. Glassglue is about to mutter something in a tone too low to be caught, and, stepping sideways, vanish. Mr. Earbrass has been rashly skimming through the early chapters, which he has not looked at for months, and now sees TUH for what it is. Dreadful, dreadful, dreadful! He must be mad to go on enduring the unexquisite agony of writing when it all turns out dreadful. Mad, why didn't he become a spy? How does one become one? He will burn the MS. Why is there no fire? Why aren't there the makings of one? How did he get in the unused room on the third floor? Mr. Earbrass returned from a walk to find a large carton blocking the hall. Masses of brow paper and then tissue have reluctantly given up an unnerving silver-gilt combination, apparent in candelabrum. Mr. Earbrass recollects a letter from a hitherto unknown admirer of his work, received the week before. It hinted at the early arrival of an offering that embodied in a different but kindred form the same high-souled aspiration that animated its recipient's books. Mr. Earbrass can only conclude that the apathy of the lower figures is due to their having been deprived of novels. Even more harrowing than the first chapters of a novel are the last, for Mr. Earbrass, anyway. The characters have one and all become thoroughly tiresome, as though he had been trapped at the same party with them since the day before. Neglected sections of the plot loom on every hand, waiting to be disposed of. His verbs seem to have withered away, and his adjectives to be proliferating past control. Furthermore, at this stage he inevitably gets insomnia. Even rereading The Truffle Plantation, his first novel, does not induce sleep. In The Blue Horror of Dawn, the vines in the carpet appear likely to begin twining up his ankles. Though TUH is within less than a chapter of completion, Mr. Earbrass has felt it has cultural and civic duty and a source of possible edification to attend a performance at Lying in the Way of Prawns, the Nephew's Tragedy, has been put on for the first time since the early 17th century by the Westmorchshire impassioned amateurs of Melpomene. Unfortunately, Mr. Earbrass is unable to take in even one of its five plots because he cannot get those few unwritten pages out of his mind. In the brief moment between day and night, when everything seems to have stopped for good and all, Mr. Ibras has written the last sentence of TUH. The room's appearance of tidiness and Mr. Ibras's of calm are alike deceptive. The MS is stuffed all anyhow in the lower right-hand drawer of the desk, and Mr. Ibras himself is wildly distraught. His feet went to sleep some time ago. There is a dull throbbing behind his left ear, and his mustache feels as uncomfortable as if it were false or belonged to someone else. The next day, Mr. Ibras is conscious, but very little more. He wanders through the house, leaving doors open and empty teacups on the floor. From time to time, the thought occurs to him that he really ought to go and dress, and he gets up several minutes later, only to sit down again in the first chair he comes to. The better part of a week will have elapsed before he has recovered enough to do anything more helpful. Some weeks later, with pen, ink, scissors, paste, a decanter of sherry, and a vast reluctance, Mr. Ibras begins to revise TUH. This means, first, transposing passages, or revising the order of their paragraphs, or crumpling them up furiously and throwing them in the wastebasket. After that, there is rewriting. This is worse than merely writing, because not only does he have to think up new things just the same, but at the same time, try not to remember the old ones. Before Mr. Ibras is through, at least one-third of TUH will bear no resemblance to its original state. Mr. Ibras sits on the opposite side of the study from his desk, gathering courage for the worst part of all in the undertaking of a novel, i.e. making a clean copy of the final version of the MS. Not only is it repulsive to the eye and hand, which is, with its tattered edges, stains, rumpled patches, scratchings out, and scribblings, but its contents are, by this time, boring to the point of madness. A freshly filled inkwell, new pheasant feather pens, and two reams of the most expensive cream-laid paper are negligible inducements for embarking on such a loathsome proceeding. Holding TUH, not very neatly done up in pink butcher's paper, which was all he could find in a last-minute search before leaving to catch his train for London, Mr. Ibras arrives at the offices of his publishers to deliver it. The stairs look oddly menacing, as though he might break a leg on one of them. Suddenly, the whole thing strikes him as very silly, and he thinks he will go and drop his parcel off the embankment and thus save everyone concerned a good deal of fuss. Mr. Ibras escaped from Monsieur Scuffle and Duskoff, who were most anxious to go into all the ramifications of a scheme for having his novel translated into Urdu, and went to call on a distant cousin. The latter was planning to do the antique shops this afternoon. So Mr. Ibras agreed to join him in the 18th shop they have visited. The cousin thinks he sees a rare sort of luster jug, and Mr. Ibras irritatedly wonders why anyone should have a fantod stuffed and put under a glass bell. The night before returning home to Mortshire, Mr. Ibras allows himself to be taken to a literary dinner in a private dining room of La Trotter Imbecile. Among his fellow authors, few of whom he recognizes and none of whom he knows, are Locke, Sandwich, Hopworth, Avuncular, and Lord Legbail. The unwell-looking gentleman, wrapped in a greatcoat, is an obscure essayist named Frost. The talk deals with disappointing sales, inadequate publicity, worse than inadequate royalties, idiotic or criminal reviews, others declining talent, and the unspeakable horror of the literary life. TUH is over, so to speak, but far from done with. The galleries have arrived, and Mr. Earbrass goes over them with mingled excitement and disgust. It all looks so different, set up in type, that at first the thought they had sent him the... At first he thought they had sent him the wrong ones, by mistake. He is quite giddy from trying to physically control the sheets and, at the same time, keep the amount of absolutely necessary changes within allowable pecuniary limits. Mr. Earbrass has received the sketch for the dust wrapper of TUH. Even after staring at it continuously for 20 minutes, he really cannot believe it. Whatever were they thinking of? That drawing, those colors, ugh, on any book it would be ugly, vulgar, and illegible. On his book it would be these, and also disastrously wrong. Mr. Earbrass looks forward to an exhilarating hour of conveying these sentiments to Scuffle and Duskoff. Things continue to come. This time, Mr. Earbrass's 6 free copies of TUH. There are, alas, at least 3 times that number of people who expect to receive one of them. Buying the requisite number of additional copies does not happen to be the solution, as it will come out almost at once, and everyone would be very angry at his wanton distribution of them to just anyone, and write him little notes of thanks, ending with the remark that TUH seems rather dull, rather down from your usual level of polish. But then you were probably in a hurry for the money. If it didn't come out, the list would be 3 times larger for his next book. Today, TUH is published, and Mr. Earbrass has come into another millstone to do some errands which could not be put off any longer. He has been uncharacteristically thorough about doing them, and it is late afternoon before he pauses in front of a bookseller's window on the way back to his car, having made certain, out of the corner of his eye, a copy of TUH was in it. He is carefully reading the title of every other book there in a state of extreme and pointless embarrassment. Scuffle and Duskoff have thoughtfully, if graciously, sent all the papers with reviews in them. They make a gratifyingly large heap. Mr. Earbrass refuses to be intimidated into rushing through them. But he is having a certain amount of difficulty in concentrating on, or rather, making any sense whatever out of a compendium of the minor heresies of the 12th century in Asia Minor. He has been meaning to finish it ever since he began it 2 years and 7 months before, at which time he bogged down on page 33. At an afternoon foregathering at the vicarage, vaguely in Mr. Earbrass's honor, where he has been busy handing round cups of tea, he is brought up short by Cole Knout, MFH of the Blathering Hunt. He demands to know just what Mr. Earbrass was getting at in the last scene of chapter 14. Mr. Earbrass is afraid he doesn't know what the colonel is. Is what? Getting at himself. The colonel snorts. Mr. Earbrass sighs. This encounter, which will go on for some time and get nowhere, will leave Mr. Earbrass feeling very weak indeed. Mr. Abrast stands on the terrace at twilight. It is bleak, it is cold, and the virtue has gone out of everything. Words drift through his mind. Anguish, turnips, conjunctions, illness, defeat, string, parties, no parties, urns, destitute, disaffection, claws, loss, Trebizond, napkins, shame, stones, distance, fever, antipodes, mush, glaciers, incoherence, labels, miasma, amputation, tides, deceit, mourning, elsewords. Before he knew what he was doing, Mr. Earbrass found he had every intention of spending a few weeks on the continent. In a trance of efficiency which could have surprised no one more than himself, he made the complicated and maddening preparations for his departure in no time at all. Now, at dawn, he stands quite numb, with cold and trepidation, looking at the churning surface of the channel. He assumes he will be horribly sick for hours and hours, but it doesn't matter. Though he is a person to whom things do not happen, perhaps they may when he is on the other side. The Listing Attic. There was a young lady named Rose who fainted whenever she chose. She did so one day while playing croquet, but was quickly revived with a hose. A headstrong young woman in Ealing threw her 2 weeks old child at the ceiling. When quizzed why she did, she replied to be rid of a strange, overpowering feeling. They had come in the fugue to the stretto, when a dark bearded man from a ghetto slipped forward and grabbed her tresses and stabbed her to death with a rusty stiletto. A certain young man, it was noted, went about in the heat thickly coated. He said, "You may scoff, but I shan't take it off. Underneath I am horribly bloated." A lady was seized with intent to revise her existence misspent. So she climbed up the dome of St. Peter's in Rome, where she stayed through the following Lent. There was a young woman whose stammer was atrocious, and so was her grammar. But they were not improved when her husband was moved to knock out her teeth with a hammer. A dreary young bank clerk named Finnis wished to foster an aura of menace. To make people afraid, he wore gloves of gray suede and white footgear intended for tennis, while his duchess lay practically dead. The Duke of Daguerreotrague said, "Can it be this has all? How puny, how small, how destroyed this disgrace to my bed." To a weepy young woman in Thrums, her betrothed remarked, "This is what comes of allowing your tears to fall into my ears. I think they have rotted the drums." A gift was delivered to Laura from a cousin who lived in Gomorrah. Wrapped in tissue and crepe, it was peeled like a grape and emitted a pale greenish aura. A clerical student named Prine through pain sought to reach the divine. He wore a hair shirt, quite often ate dirt, and bathed every Friday in brine. "Il y a une jeune fille amoureuse, d'un homme qui une conduite honteuse. Il l'amène chaque soir à son caveau noir, et là-bas, avec plainte crapuleuse. My trip? It was vile, baklava. I loathed. Etna was crawling with lava. The ship was all white, but it creaked in the night. And the band, they did not know La Java. There was a young woman named Plunnery, who rejoiced in the practice of gunnery, till one day, unobservant, she blew up a servant and was forced to retire to a nunnery. A young man of acumen and daring, who'd amassed a great fortune in herring, was left quite alone when it soon became known that their use at his board was unsparing. The partition of Vavasour Scowls was a sickener. They came on his bowels. In a firkin his brain was found clogging a drain, and his toes were inside of some towels. As the breeches boy buoy swung towards the rocks, its occupant cried, "Save my socks!" I could not bear the loss, for with scarlet silk floss my mama has embroidered their clocks. An innocent maiden named Herridge was cruelly tricked into marriage. When she later found out what her spouse was about, she threw herself under a carriage. Le salon de la vie de Trieste. Son vaisseau Saragosse et Lunest. Parmi les grandes chaises, en cause des malaises, des étropiements et des pestes. Some Harvard men, stalwart and hairy, drank up several bottles of sherry. In the yard around three, they were shrieking with glee, "Come on out, we are burning a ferry." An Edwardian father named Udgeon, whose offspring provoked him to dudgeon, used on Saturday nights to turn down the lights and chase them around with a bludgeon. The babe, with a cry brief and dismal, fell into the water baptismal. Ere they'd gone, gathered its plight, it had sunk out of sight, for the depth of the font was abysmal. A lady both callous and brash met a man with a vast black moustache. She cried, "Shave it, oh do, and I'll put it with glue on my hat as a sort of panache." A quest in a household, a guest in a household quite charmless, was informed its eccentric was harmless. If you're caught unawares at the head of the stairs, just remember he's eyeless and armless. A beetling young woman named Pridgets has had a violent abhorrence of midgets. Off the end of a wharf, she once pushed a dwarf, whose truncation reduced her to fidgets. A lady born under a curse used to drive forth each day in a hearse. From the back she would wail through a thickness of veil. Things do not get better, but worse. Each night father fills me with dread when he sits on the foot of my bed. I'd not mind that he speaks and gibbers and squeaks, but for 17 years he's been dead. There was a young curate whose brain was deranged from the use of cocaine. He lured a small child to a copse dark and wild, where he beat it to death with his cane. A young man grew increasingly peaky in a house where the hinges were squeaky. The ferns are curled up brown, the ceilings flaked down, and all of the faucets were leaky. The first child of a Mrs. Keats Shelley came to light with its face and its belly. Her second was born with a hump and a horn, and her third was as shapeless as jelly. There was a young woman named Els, who was subject to curious spells. When got up very oddly, she'd cry out things ungodly by the palms in expensive hotels. At whist drives and strawberry teas, Van would giggle and show off her knees. But when she was alone, she'd drink eau de cologne and weep from a sense of unease. There was a young sportsman named Peel, who went for a trip on his wheel. He pedaled for days through crepuscular haze, and returned feeling somewhat unreal. A timid young woman named Jane found parties a terrible strain. With movements uncertain, she'd hide in a curtain and make sounds like a rabbit in pain. Said a girl who upon her divan was attacked by a virile young man. Such excess of passion is quite out of fashion, and she fractured his wrist with her fan. A moine au milieu de la masse s'éleva et cria en détresse. La vie religieuse, c'est ça la et affreuse, et se poignarda dans la fesse. Augustus, for splashing his soup, was put for the night on the stoop. In the morning he'd not repented a jot, and next day he was dead of the croup. A young lady who lived by the usk subsisted each day on a rusk. She ate the first bite before it was light, and the last crumb some time after dusk. At the Villa Nemesia, the sleepers are disturbed by a phantom and weepers. It beats all night long, a dirge on a gong, as it staggers about in the creepers. There was a young lady named Fleeker, who was terribly, terribly eager to be all the rage on the tragedy stage, though her talents were pitifully meager. A lady who signs herself Vexed writes to say she believes she's been hexed. I don't mind my shins being stuck full of pins, but I fear I am coming unsexed. A gentleman, otherwise meek, detested with passion the leek. When offered one out, he dealt such a clout to the maid she was down for a week. While traveling in farthest Tibet, Lord Irongate found cause to regret the buttered-up tea, a pain in his knee, and the frivolous tourists he met. To his club-footed child, said Lord Stipple, as he poured his past prandial tipple, "Your mother's behavior gave pain to our Savior, and that's why he made you a cripple." From the bathing machine came a din of a jollification within. It was heard far and wide, and the incoming tide had a definite flavor of gin. As tourists inspected the apse, an ominous series of raps came from under the altar, which caused some to falter, and others to shriek and collapse. Pour guérir en accès de fièvre, un jeune homme poursuivi un lièvre. Il le prit à son trou et fit faire un ragoût des entrailles et des pâtes à Genève. A nurse motivated by spite tied her infantine charge to a kite. She launched it with ease on the afternoon breeze and watched till it flew out of sight. There's a rather odd couple in Hertz, who are cousins, or so each asserts. Their sex is in doubt, for they're never without their mustaches and long trailing skirts. The Dowager Duchess of Spout collapsed on the height of a rout. She found strength to say, as they bore her away, "I should never have taken the trout." Said Francesca, "My lack of volition is leading me straight to perdition, but I haven't the strength to go to the length of making an act of contrition." The sight of the guests filled Lord Cray at breakfast with horrid dismay. So he launched off the spoons and the pits from his prunes, at their heads as they neared the buffet. An incautious young woman named Ven was seen with the wrong sort of men. She vanished one day, but the following May her legs were retrieved from a fen. An indefatigable woman named Bavel had often occasion to travel. On the way she would sit and furiously knit, and on the way back she'd unravel. Having made a remark rather coarse, a young lady was seized with remorse. She fled from the room, and later a groom saw her rolling about in the gorse. An old gentleman's crotchets and quibblings were a terrible trial to his siblings, but he was not removed till one day it was proved that the bell ropes were damp with his dribblings. There was a young man named Fred, who spent every Thursday in bed. He lay with his feet outside of the sheet and the pillows on top of his head. From number 9, Penwiper Mews, there is really abominable news. They've discovered a head in the box for the bread, but nobody seems to know whose. There was a young man who appeared to his friends with a full growth of beard. They at once said, "Although we can't say why it's so, the effect is uncommonly weird." Ce livre est dédié à chagrin, qui fit un petit mannequin. Son bras est tout noir, il était affreux. En effet, absolument la fin.